You're listening to an encore edition of Studio Tulsa recorded earlier this year. Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. For American parents, the ideal is to have children that grow up healthy, are happy and well-adjusted, and independent. In fact, one of the great fears of American parenting today is of a phenomenon that has a variety of euphemisms. The boomerang kid, an accordion family, and the worst of the lot, failure to launch. Today, more and more children in their 20s and 30s are living with their parents, both here in America and in other industrialized countries. And that result is eliciting a variety of reactions. My guest today has investigated this social trend and pushes back against the notion held by some that overindulgent parents have raised a generation that is unwilling to grow up. Sociologist Catherine Newman researched countries where boomerang kid rates are growing and found very complex reasons for why they are, and some surprising attitudes from people in countries where the rates remain low. Her book, The Accordion Family, Boomerang Kids, Anxious Parents, and the Private Toll of Global Competition, address some of those issues. It's published by Beacon Press. Catherine Newman is a professor of sociology and dean of the Krieger School of Arts and Sciences at Johns Hopkins University. She has written 10 books on economic class issues, and she joins us today on Studio Tulsa. Catherine Newman, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
And thanks for having me.
When most people think about the terms boomerang kids and accordion families, we really tend to think of the poor economic prospects and a failure to launch. That ideas of children in their 20s and 30s coming home, we think of it strictly in economic terms. And there's certainly truth there. But the larger explanation is perhaps a little more complex. What did you find?
It isn't just the economy. The economy is playing an important role in making forces that were there before more intense. For probably the last 20, 25 years, we have seen increasing demand for higher education, more credentials in order to manage a career in the professions. And so it's taking our young people longer and it's costing them more to get to where they want to go relative to earlier generations. This is leaving them with extraordinary burdens in terms of loans when they finish undergraduate school, at exactly the time when the economy is providing less opportunity for entry-level workers. You put that combination together, and what you discover is that they are in a situation where they really can't manage on their own, many of them, millions of them. And so because their families are committed to seeing them through this project of becoming professionals, they are tending to head home and to shelter some of the costs involved in becoming the kind of person they want to be as adults underneath the roof of mom and dad.
Another leg of that is housing costs, too, which
exactly.
until the big bust here, housing costs were escalating greatly. So it was a bigger task to find affordable housing to get started.
That is exactly right. And in countries like Japan or Spain or Italy, countries that I've studied for this book as well, there is no option to go into the rental market, because there's very little rental housing in those countries. They tend to be countries with very high levels of owner occupancy. Here in the United States, there is a larger rental sector, and that does help. But even that got to be quite expensive, and even after the crash in the housing markets, we still see problems of affordability, because at the same time that the housing markets went down, so did unemployment go up and wages go down. So all in all, it's just becoming more expensive for young people to be on their own at the same time that they've got these massive loans to take care of. Now, I wouldn't want you to get the impression that this accordion family phenomenon is entirely a function of the economy, because there are other cultural issues at play here. It is not as difficult for young people to come home after college as it once was, because they see the world in similar terms to their parents. The generation gap that was so famously part of the experience of the baby boomers isn't really there very much anymore. Baby boomer parents and their millennial generation kids often share tastes in movies, in restaurants, in politics, in film. Culturally, they are a lot more alike than they are different. And that makes it easier because they're not at loggerheads with one another. Similarly, the parents who spent most of their time working throughout their children's upbringing aren't quite as tired of them as their parents were of them. When I was a kid growing up, My mother, who stayed home to take care of four kids, that's a typical boomer family, she loved us. She still loves us very much. But at 18, she had spent a lot of time with us. Well, that's not true for me. I worked all the way through my children's infancy, more or less from the day they were born. And that's typical of many boomer parents. They're in dual career couples where everyone was working phenomenal hours, so that by the time the kids reach 18, they're not quite as sick of them. They actually miss them. Their experience of child rearing is much more of being rushed and having not enough time to do all the things families want to do together.
I'm kind of reminded of the Indiana Jones movie with his father, and he says, "You left when you got interesting."
Well, yeah, and as I said, if there's no generation gap so that parents and kids get along pretty well, the baby boom generation was the one that went through the kind of experience of changing mores around gender or around sexual behavior. So if their kids want to bring a girlfriend home or a boyfriend home, you know, the boomers generation isn't going to shrug over that. They were the ones who were, you know, out there experimenting with their lives in their youth. So there isn't as much of a gulf around that. So the loss of privacy or autonomy around one's personal intimacy decisions isn't nearly as compromised as it might have been in earlier years. So I think the accordion family is a combination of economic necessity and cultural changes that have brought these generations closer to one another and therefore makes it a little bit less painful. But if it goes on too long, if Sally is not making moves to get that master's degree or take that internship that will allow her to get the sort of job her parents want her to have, then everybody gets nervous. Because right. Now it's a comment on the long-term prospects of the next generation.
What was interesting before we move on to that, I was really struck by, you know, the timeline culturally. Was the baby boomer generation gap more an aberration, or has that been the way it has been in past generations? I mean, when you look back a number of generations, multi-generational families was pretty common in all the countries you studied.
Absolutely. Multi-generational families were absolutely the norm. What was different was the age of marriage. So in the long-distant past, Italians stayed home with their parents until they married, but they married when they were 18 or 21, and now they're getting married when they're 32 or 35. So in a sense, the social principle of staying at home until you marry has remained constant, but the length of time that that period is occupying of the non-married state is way, way longer than it ever was before. So I think that some of the things that are changing have to do with the affordability of marriage or the desirability of marriage in Japan. You know, many of the women that I interviewed looked upon marriage, especially if they were going to consider marrying the eldest son in another family, as, well, you know, my mother became the sort of servant of her mother-in-law. Is that really what I want to do with my life? And they don't think it's very appealing. So there are things that are changing preferences about marriage that are affecting the length of time that young people stay home. So a lot of moving parts out there.
Well, one of the things you tackle is what the definition of adulthood is. In fact, that's very much changing. One of the, you know, the great norms of adulthood was when you moved out of the house and you were on your own supporting yourself. Now exactly. That definition is changing from culture to culture. What was your sense of what the definition of adulthood is for these adults who are living at home with their parents?
I tried to coin a phrase in the middle of this book of what I called in-house adulthood. What I meant there was that when a person comes back home who's in their mid-20s, it's not like having a 15-year-old back. That's a different person. They have greater autonomy, they have more independence, but they're not fully independent, and they are not fully financially responsible either. So what happens is a kind of partial evolution toward adulthood with a whole different set of markers, because the markers we're used to simply aren't coming at the same point in life. Marriage isn't there. The end of education may not be there. Starting a new family, that could be postponed for many years. All of these markers that we might think of as objective markers, you could count that with a Census Bureau questionnaire, are receding at the same time that these people are actually getting older, and they don't look like they're 15. So what then is adulthood? It's more psychological. It's, do I feel more responsible for myself? Do I feel more autonomous? Do I think about myself as someone with decisions to make that are consequential? Not do I possess all of these characteristics that used to define adulthood, because probably I don't.
We talked a little bit about the four countries that you spent a lot of time interviewing folks in, and that's Italy, Japan, the U.S., and Spain. Each society views this situation of adult children coming back home to the family to live for a portion of time, or in some cases never leaving. The reaction varies from culture to culture, and it's pretty interesting, both the parents and the children's take. Can you give sort of run through these four countries and how they view this situation? Italy, for example, multi-generational families is something, it's a great joy from the parents' perspective.
I did find this fascinating because the demographics are so similar from one country to the other, and even the causes, the economic causes, are also very similar. But the experience is so different. So in Italy, where multi-generation households have been around for a long time, even if they're getting longer in duration, the overwhelming sentiment I found was that this is normal, this is lovely, why would my children ever leave me? And very little of the anxiety that you see in Japan or the United States about someone turning 32, 33, and they're still at home and mama is still doing the laundry. Almost no anxiety. Now, the government of Italy is extremely anxious about this because it is undermining the entire system of whatever they have in terms of Social Security. Most countries depend on having a relatively young and productive workforce to support a smaller and unproductive retired population. I mean, economically unproductive. And in Italy, that pyramid is just not working out that way. It's like the pyramid's flipped in the other direction. They've got an older and older, larger, older group, and a smaller number of people being born. So in a country that was famous for having families that were, you know, 10 kids, they are below replacement level fertility now. Their country is shrinking in population and getting older. The same thing is true in Japan and in Spain. Now, in the U.S., we would look like that if we didn't have a significant immigrant population. It's the immigrant families in the U.S. that typically have a larger number of children. So when we add everybody up, we get no problem of fertility in the U.S. But if you look at these countries that have no tradition of immigration, what you get is an older country that's shrinking in its population, and that is hugely problematic. But in Italy, for ordinary people, this is not a problem. For the government, it's a huge headache. In Spain, ordinary people are furious about the conditions that have led their children to become boomeranged or never leave. So it's not that they don't love their kids, but they say, my child has no opportunity. Why does my child have no opportunity? Because the government created changes in labor laws that disadvantaged my child and gave them nothing but part-time jobs or short-term jobs to look forward to.
And, of course, we have to look at Spain over the long term. Spain was very repressive for many, many years. Multi-generational families were very common. And then it has just recently changed where, you know, you had a generation that moved out very quickly, and now that's becoming less prevalent again.
Well, exactly. But the other thing I found fascinating about Spain is that its political history is one that left the older generation of boomers. That was a generation of political activists. They were people who fought against the Franco regime, which only ended in 1975. And so they see much of their social history through the lens of politics and protest. But that's not true of the Italians, and it's definitely not true of the Japanese. So in the Japanese case, this is a country that has gone through several decades of economic stagnation. And their newspapers are filled with stories about the lost decade or the lost two decades. There's ample recognition that Japan has gone through a tremendous economic downturn and then stagnation. But when you ask parents, why are your children at home at such an advanced age, they never say, oh, because the government changed the contract regime or big business, you know, decided to lay people off. It's never about those economic forces. It's always about that psychological analysis. That generation is bad. That generation has defaulted on being good, on understanding their place in society.
In fact, they refer to it as parasite singles.
Exactly. And this is, by the way, enough to create something close to a social panic in Japan. This isn't a small thing. This stops the presses in Japan, and it causes newspapers and television to focus on this parasitical generation, as they call it. And then the parents turn around to themselves and they say, and how did that parasite generation come to be the way they are? Well, because we produced them. So we raised them badly.
So there's a very strong sense of shame among the parents of this generation that's living at home.
Shame, embarrassment, mm-hmm. anger, very mm-hmm. little in the way of understanding that the economy shifted under their feet and created a set of second-tier jobs that do not pay enough or offer enough opportunity for people to become homeowners and become independent.
And that's probably a thing we don't understand here in the West, is that we think of, you know, these lifetime contracts with the big industrial companies of Japan. That era is over in Japan.
It's been over 20 years.
And the parents maybe still be benefiting from that, but the next generation are working oftentimes part-time workers or temporary jobs with very little benefits without that sort of business social net that earlier generation had.
And what I think from an outsider's point of view looks like a really sharp structural change, from an insider's point of view feels like it's volitional. Somehow these kids chose to do this. From my point of view, these are changes that were not under their control.
Mm-hmm. Now, the U.S. is sort of an amalgam of all four of those approaches, aren't they?
We are very much in the middle, and that's one of the great value of studying other countries, which is that you start to see your own through a different lens. When I began this book, I thought the U.S. was sort of on the extreme end of these accordion families, but it turns out we're not. We're really in the middle. We do have a very sharp rising rate of young people coming home, but we put more money into that transitional period than do the Japanese or the Spaniards. We build universities with dormitories. We have a large rental sector in our housing. We provide financial aid for college. Not enough, never enough, and we're certainly nowhere near as generous as the Nordic countries, but relative to Japan or Spain, we're way ahead. So we do more. And that's why we have a growing accordion family issue, but not nearly as big as those other countries and not for as long as they have it. So we're really in the middle, and we enjoy having our children at home as long as they're making a move toward upward mobility. And if they're not, that's a different story. So our cultural anxieties are about mobility. They're about occupational success. They're about our identity in the workplace. And if our kids are not making those moves, we get really nervous quickly. And if Johnny's in the basement playing video games, we're not happy with that. So we're very conditional in our approval. We are happy to have them home as long as it's not permanent, all the tracks are in place to bring it to an end, and that's not true in every family.
My guest today is Catherine Newman, a professor of sociology at Johns Hopkins University, and she's the dean of the Krieger School of Arts and Sciences. She specializes in economic class issues. Her latest book is titled The Accordion Family, Boomerang Kids, Anxious Parents, and the Private Toll of Global Competition. It's published by Beacon Press, and she's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Well, let's talk about the rates, because I know the charts that you had available to you include the 19-year-olds, which that could conceivably be the last year of high school. But based on those rates, you're looking at 60-70% in Italy, well over 50% in Spain and Japan. The U.S. is maybe a little less. But if we take outside those kids finishing high school and beginning college, what are the real rates of people in their mid-20s, early 30s living at home? Do we have any sort of good statistics?
What we have are numbers rising over time. So we see just an enormous increase over the last 10 years in these rates. It's pretty staggering, actually, but nowhere near as enormous as those other countries. They are really hitting the majority. Now, we do see a majority of our young people coming home after they've finished college. That has jumped up. It's now around 85%. So it's become something close to a universal experience in the U.S. But how long they do so and under what conditions, that can vary from one community to another. And I should say, by the way, that although I'm speaking about Americans in a broad, universal sense, there are huge differences internal to the U.S. by income group. The wealthy in our country, the upper middle class, can afford to help their children be residentially independent, even if they're financially dependent, right? So mom and dad might be paying the rent, might be, you know, helping to fund that kid while they're taking an internship, but they might actually be living apart because they're in the bank of mom and dad while they're not in the inn of mom and dad, if you will. The middle class will find it very difficult to do those things simultaneously. So the middle class may have their kids at home, but are helping to finance the higher education they need to get on their feet later on. Working class and poor households have never been able to let their children be independent. At an early age, very often those young people, if they're going to go to college anyway, they live at home, they work part-time, they go to school part-time. It takes them a long time to finish their college degrees because of this in-out pattern. And at the very bottom, among the poor, where often people are not going to college at all, now you get the opposite strain. You get young people who want to leave home, and their parents can't afford to let them, because they need all the money that's being earned by all of the earners in the extended family to stay under one roof and fund one household.
And that's
so
that's,
there are tremendous variations within our country.
Mm-hmm. I was going to say, that goes back about four or five generations in American history where more families were like that.
Oh, easily. And, of course, during the Great Depression, it was absolutely the norm. You went to work and you turned over your pay packet to your parents when you came home at the end of the day on Friday, because the household could not survive without pooling all of those earnings.
You know, it was interesting that when you're looking at globalization's effects. You know, a lot of times I think a lot of people would think that globalization would have a more profound effect on older workers rather than younger workers. But in fact, that is indeed the case, especially in a lot of these industrialized countries such as Italy or Spain or Germany, or countries that have a sort of a nationality that is intrinsic to citizenship and the social fabric. You would think that with the low birth rates and the fact that their population is growing, it would be a boon for younger workers. But it's not.
Well, you would think so, but it doesn't turn out to be like that. And maybe it would look more like that if we were not in a global economic downturn, which has been going on for a very long time now. It gets a little bit harder when economies have turned down and globalization will turn them all down at the same time. You know, I've done a lot of research in South Africa, for example. It took quite a while for the Great Recession to reach South Africa. But once it did, it hit like a thunder, and it created unemployment rates of over 25% within the space of about a year and a half. So the interlinked nature of the world economy makes it harder and harder to shield people against these pressures. Nonetheless, there are policy decisions to be made here that do make a difference. So in the Nordic countries, in the social democracies of Sweden, Denmark, Finland, we don't see accordion families. That's not because they're doing so well economically, so much better than the rest of us. They have very high youth unemployment problems. They have tremendous hits to their economy from global competition. The Finns are somewhat saved by North Sea gas. That helps them quite a bit. But the rest of the Nordic countries have been no more successful than we have in warding off the complexities and damage of globalization. But they don't have accordion families, so why not? The answer is, in those social democracies, the tax system redistributes in a way that favors young people, that protects them from this dependency on their parents. They can have something pretty close to free higher education. And their average age of school completion is 27 years old. So they're in school for a very long time, and it's paid for mostly by the state. They have an enormous rental sector that's mostly state-owned, which means there are low rents, and the state or the municipalities are very generous in providing that rental housing to young people. So if you're 16 years old in Denmark and you want to go study at a specialized high school in another city than the one where you grew up, you can move to that other city. The government will pay for the move. It will put you on a stipend while you're there. At 16. So as a result, you don't see young people, in a sense, tethered to the household. They're tethered to the state, if you want to put it that way.
Mm-hmm.
But their experience is very much one of more autonomous economically autonomous existence than our 16-year-olds or 18-year-olds. So there are policy differences that can affect whether or not accordion families emerge and at what rate and for how long, even though globalization will impose very similar kinds of economic constraints on the economies in which they live.
Now, did you find a pretty strong correlation between the strength of the social net within the country and the prevalence of accordion families?
Yes. The stronger the safety net, the less frequent we have accordion families, because the stronger the safety net, the more alternative resources young people have that they can use to preserve independence if that's what they want, and that is mostly what they want. What I found curious about the Nordic countries, and absolutely did not expect, is that that lack of dependence between generations generates a certain degree of uneasiness about the emotional fabric or connections between generations. So if you don't need each other economically, do you need each other at all? That seemed to be much more of a question than I expected. So I found Scandinavian families speaking as if there was a certain degree of built-in loneliness between the generations. They don't see each other as much. They don't eat together as much. The parents don't feel obligated to take care of their children after the age of 18. And everyone would think it was strange if anyone was at home after that age. So they were questioning whether this was so healthy for their societies. And when I would ask them why this pattern looked so different in Italy or Spain, because they knew that this was the case, the Nordic families would say, well, maybe they love each other more than we do. And there was a certain kind of, wow, it was scary. It made me realize why someone like Stieg Larsson, who wrote the Dragon Tattoo series, why would you have these tales, these fictional tales of unbelievable mayhem between total strangers in a society that's famous for its sort of egalitarianism and social contract? I always thought that was sort of peculiar, but now I think I understand it a little bit better. There is something at the center of societies that have removed the dependencies between generations that may not sit too well.
That must have been somewhat of a surprise.
I was totally stunned. I thought I was going to those countries because I would be able there to study what hadn't happened.
Yeah, they had the answers.
Instead, I found something else.
Right, exactly. Well, it's really interesting. Getting back to those Scandinavian countries, do you see other signs of sort of filling in the demographic gaps by having that independence, or are their birth rates just as low as the rest of Europe?
No, their birth rates are higher. They're not higher than ours, but they're higher than the countries of the European South. And that's partly because, in addition to being very good to their young people, they're incredibly generous to families. They provide, universal free child care. They also provide something pretty close to universal free elder care. So all the way around, the things that cause us to gnash our teeth and, scan our bank accounts anxiously don't really affect Nordic families. They can depend on government for all kinds of things. Now, they pay very high taxes in order to support that, but once they've paid those taxes, all the things that we have to scramble around to pay for, they don't worry about too much.
But as you mentioned, they have other problems based on that generosity of the state.
Interestingly, yes. Yeah. And as I said, I thought I was going to be looking at Nirvana, and it turns out Nirvana has a little bit of a sharp edge to it.
Yeah. One last question. Around many of these countries in the southern European area, you're looking at major austerity programs. Great Britain as well, which is you didn't study that, but they're also seeing more accordion families. The United States, based on the rhetoric of the political situation, it looks like austerity is a growing movement for austerity. We're going to see more accordion families as a result?
I think we will, because what austerity means is cutting government spending, and wherever government spending is cut, the family steps in as the safety net of last resort.
Catherine Newman, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Sociologist Catherine Newman speaking with us here on Studio Tulsa. Her new book is titled The Accordion Family, Boomerang Kids, Anxious Parents, and the Private Toll of Global Competition. It's published by Beacon Press. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.